This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Welcome to Radio EcoShock. I'm your reporter, Alex Smith. Later in this program, we will tackle a serious worldwide problem seldom discussed, the toxic and harsh environmental impacts of mining. We have a case study from the United States, the Polymet mine proposed for northern Minnesota. Our environmental correspondent, Jerry Williams, has been on the job with original interviews from activists, just local people, really, trying to protect nature from yet another hack job. This isn't a story about Minnesota or even America. Giant mines are operating or being developed all over the world to feed our consumer desires. They spew pollution, carve into the wilderness, and leave behind heavy metal leaching into rivers and lakes for hundreds of years. It's Canada, Australia, Africa, Asia, and all the European companies carving giant holes into the crust of the earth. Before we get there, I need to alert you to yet another disgusting development coming from the world's nuclear mafia. It's a general go-ahead to dump hundreds of thousands of tons of radioactive water into the Pacific Ocean. Incredibly, everyone from the American head of the NRC to the International Energy Agency and Japanese authorities are giving a green light to empty those thousands of radioactive tanks at Fukushima right into the ocean. Who gives anyone permission to make the seas more radioactive? Why can't the country that used dangerous nuclear power keep the inevitable mess to themselves? Let's dig in deeper to recent developments at the triple meltdown that is the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear catastrophe. It's hardly worth mentioning Fukushima has set a new all-time record for radioactive pollution just this month. Listen to this from Arirang Korea TV News, December 2, 2013.
Now, media in Japan on this Tuesday are reporting that the level of radiation detected in an observation well at the crippled Fukushima Daiichi nuclear power plant has soared to an all-time high. Plant operator TEPCO said that 1.1 million becquerels of beta ray-emitting radioactive material had been detected per liter in water samples taken on November 28th. The figure is 36,000 times higher than the normal level of 30 becquerels per liter and is more than the previous record high of 910,000 becquerels per liter detected on November 25th.
And people try to tell you this accident is over. According to the nuclear industry, 1 million becquerels of radiation is equal to 1 kilogram of what they call low-level radioactive waste, here found in every single liter of water. Water is now the huge issue at Fukushima Daiichi. Estimates of the amount of highly radioactive waste being pumped every day are hard to get by, or they vary widely. The consensus seems to be about 600 tons a day needs to be stored, perhaps 300 tons being pumped by TEPCO themselves into the underground buildings trying to cool the escaped hot reactor cores, and another 300 tons of groundwater flowing down that hill into the site and mixing with those cores. Those numbers are far too round and neat to be real, but they do give you the idea. All that is being pumped through a maze of makeshift hoses into over 1,000 tanks on the site. These tanks, we know from mainstream news reports, were shoddily made, bolted together without welding, by inexperienced workers dragged in from all over Japan. On December 5th, Reuters reported the workers were brought in illegally, at times recruited by the Japanese gangs. Workers admit they assembled tanks in weather that did not permit proper sealing. There have been regular leaks of highly radioactive water from these tanks. The Japanese admit up to 300 tons a day of water is escaping already into the Pacific, a continual source of serious radioactivity. The tanks were a make-do solution from the start. They are only designed to last until 2016. That's fast approaching. A new report from the Japanese Ministry of Industry says Fukushima, the site, will run out of room to store radioactive water within 2 years. What to do? Just dump it in the ocean, of course. Here is the alarming news. A chorus of nuclear authorities inside and outside of Japan are preparing you to accept this horrible plan. Here is a short list of the dump-it-all boosters, the first two as reported in Washington's blog. Juan Carlitos Lenhito, head of the IEA's mission to Fukushima Daiichi, December 4, 2013, quote, "Controlled discharge is a regular practice in all nuclear facilities in the world. And what we are trying to say here is to consider this as one of the options to contribute to a good balance of risks and to stabilize the facility for the long term." And here we have Shunichi Tanaka, chairman of Japan's Nuclear Regulatory Authority, quoted on December 4, 2013. You cannot keep storing the water forever. We have to make choice, comparing all risks involved, end quote. The chair of the American Nuclear Regulatory Commission, the NRC, Allison McFarland, was in Japan on December 6th when she said, at a press conference at the American Embassy, that the International Agency for Atomic Energy's recommendation to dump radioactive water into the Pacific was appropriate. Still not convinced they are all in on this? Listen to this brief clip from ABC Australia back on November 20th under the headline, TEPCO cleanup boss says Fukushima's radioactive water will be dumped into Pacific Ocean, as reported by ABC's North Asia correspondent Mark Willisey.
He's the former chief nuclear watchdog in the United States. Now, Dale Klein is overseeing TEPCO's efforts to stabilize and clean up the shattered Fukushima nuclear plant.
I think the best word to use with Fukushima is challenging.
Challenging on many fronts, but particularly when it comes to dealing with the growing volume of contaminated water stored at the plant. Dale Klein believes that after the water is treated and stripped of most radioactive elements, it'll be safe to dump into the Pacific.
If at the end of the day, when the water is discharged, it will be released in a way when it is diluted so there's no risk to the public health and safety. But it is an emotional issue.
But it's not just contaminated water causing problems at Fukushima. Hastily and shoddily built systems at the nuclear plant have also triggered some anxious moments.
In the interests of truth, and that's what we're all after, these authorities say the water must first be cleaned up of major radioactive particles like plutonium and uranium before it's dumped. They realize cesium will still be there when it goes into the Pacific, plus large amounts of tritium. They always say tritium is perfectly natural. Go ahead, brush your teeth with it. But that's not at all true. And then they blatantly say that all operating nuclear plants leak tritium daily, which you seldom hear. I know it's true. But now they tell you to bless dumping Fukushima's problem into our common ocean. The authorities act as though the technology to clean up this water is working. The filter machine on site, known as ALPS, breaks down often, including this past December 1st. It has seldom, if ever, run at its stated capacity. Even if it could, ALPS does not remove tritium and has a backlog in those tanks of several years' worth to process. And remember, those tanks will be full by 2016 and weren't designed to last beyond that, so that's not going to work. There is some resistance to this plan. On November 7th, a consortium of anti-nuclear groups presented a petition of more than 150,000 signatures to UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon demanding a global takeover of the Fukushima disaster for the protection of all. Contact nukefree.org for more information on what you can do. Bottom line, do you accept that hundreds of thousands of tons, perhaps soon to be millions of tons, of highly radioactive Fukushima water will be dumped into the Pacific Ocean? If that's not okay with you, time is limited. Contact your government, reach out to your local public. Let's stop this next nuclear disaster from happening. The Pacific Ocean is not anyone's nuclear dumping ground. Heaven help the species who live there and all of the people of the world as we sleepwalk through this awful proposal. I'm Alex Smith. This is Radio EcoShock. That's just a fun little sample from the group from northern Minnesota called the Arrowhead Story. We'll be hearing more about that. But first, here's Jerry Williams with something that just has to get out to you.
At first, it seems like the usual story. Big mining company moves into an area promising to generate local prosperity and to preserve the environment. As the search for fossil fuels and other natural resources turns more widespread and more extreme, it's a decision many communities may have to face. EcoShock turns to the story that is playing out in northern Minnesota, where citizens groups are waging a campaign against a proposed sulfide mine, the first in the state. It's ground zero for one of the country's most pristine and protected areas, and it's a case that could have wider impact throughout the country. We welcome Paula Maccabee, attorney and advocacy director for the organization Water Legacy. Welcome, Paula. Please give us a little bit of context and background about this case, where it's been and where you think it's going.
I think you put it in a nutshell that Minnesota really has some of the most outstanding freshwater resources in the world. We're not talking just about the Boundary Waters Canoe area, but also about Lake Superior, perhaps the greatest freshwater lake in the world. And what sulfide mining does is different from the history of iron and taconite mining in Minnesota. And the reason is the geology. Copper and nickel and palladium and gold are formed in a kind of rock that has a high content of sulfur. And when that rock is blasted out of the ground and ground up in order to extract the metals, the sulfur is exposed to air and water. And that sulfur turns into sulfuric acid. And not only are the sulfur compounds themselves toxic, but they leach or draw out heavy metals from the rock into either surface water, groundwater, or both. And that's why across the country, in a water-rich environment like that in northern Minnesota, there are no examples of sulfide mines where the result has not been a legacy of pollution, either to groundwater, which is drinking water, or to surface water, streams, and lakes and rivers, or to both. And that's why this is such an important issue and an important decision facing Minnesota.
Now, tell me a little bit about the PolyMet Corporation, which is proposing this sulfide mine. It's the one that's going to operate the mine, and I understand it's a slightly different kind of animal, so to speak, from previous mining entities that have worked in this area.
Well, Minnesota actually has a legacy of United States companies working in the taconite industry, and PolyMet is anything but that. It looks like it's a Canadian corporation, but that's really a shell company. And it's a shell company where almost the lion's share of the investment has come from Glencore International, which was initially based in Switzerland and was renowned or notorious as being one of the worst companies across the globe for labor strife and pollution. Now, in 2013, Glencore merged with Xstrata, which is a Chinese conglomerate. And this combined company has sales of about $200 billion a year. In other words, the company that is pushing for the PolyMet mine is not only bigger than the state of Minnesota as a whole, but bigger than many other companies. And what's even more troubling is that not only is the ownership non-local, not only is the corporate shell unlikely to have any other assets to go after if the project goes bad, but Glencore has made as an agreement part of its merger with Xstrata that for the first 8 years, all of its copper concentrate is going to China. And Glencore, as the joint venture, owns rights to at least the first 5 years of production. So we're looking at in northern Minnesota is northeastern Minnesota gets the hole in the ground. We get the legacy of hundreds of years of pollution, and this copper is going to be exported. So the value added, any value added production is going to happen elsewhere. And the profit making is happening elsewhere.
Well, the irony is that these companies always claim to be generating jobs and prosperity in the local communities. And they also say that they will leave the land the way it was, if not better. But you've indicated that sulfide mines have never really done this. And how is PolyMet matching or answering the criticism that there's no way that they can contain the pollution and the leaching into the groundwater and the habitat destruction?
Well, I think that PolyMet is not the first company to claim in their environmental review documents that they're going to be different, they're going to be unique. There was a study done by Kuypers and a number of other researchers that actually looked at all of the companies that claimed in their environmental impact statements that they wouldn't pollute, what percentage polluted. And the answer was 9 out of 10. So the fact that a company puts down in paper in a big document, in PolyMet's case, literally thousands of pages of documents, a rosy scenario doesn't mean it's going to happen. And in PolyMet's case, this is an unusually bad location to put a mine. PolyMet is proposing to put a mine on a site that not only is it now Superior National Forest, so the public is going to have to trade and get different land before this gets built and lose access to some 7,000 acres of what's now Superior National Forest. But the mine site that PolyMet is planning to put their open pit sulfide mine on is wetlands, and it's primarily peatland. So the ability that one might have in an arid climate to start from scratch and seal everything up with plastic and make sure there are no leaks is not even possible in a wetland environment. In the tailings basin, you got a different problem. PolyMet is proposing to dump its tailings on top of an old tailings basin built by a taconite facility. Now, this taconite facility for LTV was built in the 1950s. And taconite tailings, which are less toxic than sulfide mining tailings, at the time, 1950s, not a whole lot of sophistication. They thought this is just sand. So these tailings basins were built to leak. So now PolyMet is saying, oh, it's built to leak. It's designed to leak. It's a mile in diameter. But we are going to make sure that nothing gets out. That might look pretty on paper, but it doesn't match the experience at what has happened at sulfide mines and at sulfide mine tailings basins.
Well, explain to me how any commercial company can even have access to a protected forest area or, for that matter, surrounding areas that are owned by the local residents. How do they cut this kind of deal? What is the law behind their ability to do this?
Wow, good questions. The first question is, what is the law that would allow them to take Superior National Forest land? And the truth is, there are federal statutes that say a company can't just walk in and buy a national forest. What they have to do is find other land to trade that's of equal value. As of yet, there has been no process of determination of whether that land that PolyMet wants to swap for the 100-mile swamp and the headwaters of the Partridge River, whether it's really of equal value. And I have now filed 2 Freedom of Information Act claims to try and get access to see the appraisal and see what the factual basis is for claim that it's okay to trade away this national forest. So far, no documents. So part of it is we're going to have to take a really long, hard look. Is this an under-the-table deal that makes no sense, or are these lands really of equivalent value to the public so that the public, we as taxpayers and as people who enjoy the forest, are not subsidizing a mine we don't want. You asked another question, though, and that's what happens to an individual? And Minnesota has really unusual law for mining. This does not happen for other industries. Other industries, if they want to buy my house or if they want to dig a hole in my property, they have to negotiate with me in good faith and we need to make a deal. The way it is in Minnesota, the state of Minnesota retains mineral rights under 13.5 million acres of Minnesota. That's approximately 24% of the state. And law was written 100 years ago favoring the mining company, saying if they buy a lease under my home or my business or my logging industry, and I don't want to give them access, I don't want them to mine, they have the right to condemn out my property and get an easement or get the right to use the surface, even if I don't want them to. Unprecedented in other areas, but it gives the mining companies, they may be negotiating with me, but I'm negotiating at the point of a gun if there's a potential for eminent domain. Citizens are just now waking up to this risk and starting to try and put pressure on the government to change the law or at least to give adequate notice and environmental review before the state sells these leases out from under private businesses, trout streams, whatever.
Well, I'm glad you brought up, you know, that citizens and the public are becoming aware, because I've seen what I would call a change in attitude. It is very sensitive for people living in areas where mining has taken place to feel that this is their only economic lifeline and that people outside of the area really don't have any say on it. I've seen signs that say those who reside should decide. But I've heard some pushback on that, in which people are saying, I may not live right next door to you, but this land is part of the commons. It's part of my watershed. It's part of an environmental legacy I want to pass on. I'm wondering what you are hearing in response to citizens around the state and their involvement in the campaign the campaign against the sulfide mining.
Well, the campaign to prevent pollution and destruction from sulfide mining is very strongly based in northeastern Minnesota. It's not just a phenomenon of people who live in the Twin Cities. Water Legacy, we now have, I think the last time I looked, about 6,700 members. Two-thirds of our members are from northeastern Minnesota. And many of them say that they don't oppose taconite mining, because if taconite mining is done properly and there are treatment facilities for their wastewater, it is possible to comply with water quality standards. But they're saying we need to draw the line at sulfide mining pollution and destruction, and we also need to make sure that the state follows the law when they're dealing with taconite mining. So there are a lot of people in northeastern Minnesota who are saying, I can support existing taconite mining. I just want them to do a little better job of it. And I don't support the brand new risk of toxic pollution from sulfide mining. I think people from other states might not realize this. It's how important the tourism industry is in Minnesota, and how much of northeastern Minnesota's economy depends on having high quality resource values. And that's not just in the boundary waters. It's the lakes that you can swim in, lakes that you can fish in, the fish that you can take home and you can eat. One of the terrible problems with sulfide mining pollution is between the mercury that's emitted and the sulfates that go into the water and increase bioaccumulation of mercury, is sulfide mining increases the degree to which toxic mercury contaminates our fish. And what that means for tourism is you can come up here and fish, but you can't eat the fish. And for our communities who are either subsistence fisher people or Anishinaabe tribes, where eating fish is a vital part of their culture as well as their treaty rights, the answer, oh, just don't eat the fish, isn't going to work. It's not going to work for anglers. It's not going to work for tourism. It's not going to work for communities. By having sulfide mining, I'm not going to dispute. There are some jobs. There's a huge phenomenon of boom and bust, but there are some jobs. But what is being placed at risk is an economy, which actually the number of jobs in northeastern Minnesota, tourism has four times as many jobs as the mining industry. Are we going to put health? Are we going to put literally thousands of years of clean water? And are we going to put a huge portion of our economy at risk for what we know has been historically a boom and bust resource extraction industry? Doesn't sound like a really good cost-benefit analysis to benefit Minnesota.
I'm glad you brought up some of the very severe possibilities of pollution, and one that's also very relevant to the native peoples in the area is what would happen to the wild rice areas, this unique grain that Indians have been harvesting, that's part of their culture, that's economic support for them, but is uniquely also sensitive, or could be, I think it's being still studied, uniquely sensitive to the pollution from the sulfide mining. How are the Native Americans involved in this campaign as well?
Well, I came into this 4 years ago, and what I discovered when I came into it is that much of the best science, much of the most highest degree of knowledge was really possessed by the Fond du Lac, Grand Portage, and Boise Fort tribes. And they're all, in American language, we call them Chippewa or Ojibwe, with their initial name was Anishinaabe. These tribes have been, for a long time, trying to serve as stewards for lands in northeastern Minnesota. What we don't always remember is these lands, initially, the land where the Polymet mine would be located, is lands that were ceded to the United States by the Chippewa tribes under treaties. And those treaties, that this is the law of the land. As a citizen of the American government, we should want our government to follow the law of the land. The law of the land says that these tribes should have the right to hunt, fish, and gather. If federal agencies approve projects that destroy the habitat so you can't hunt, destroy the water so you can't grow wild rice and gather, destroy the and contaminate the fish so you can't fish, that government acting on our behalf as American citizens is actually violating treaties. Wild rice, in addition to having cultural importance, it has legal importance. This grain should be protected, not just because it's Minnesota's state grain, which it is, or because it's delicious, which it is, or because it actually has more protein than other rice. All is true. But because there's a treaty, and we're supposed to be following the law and protecting the resources that we promised to protect.
I'd like to just touch briefly on and get back to the economic concerns, because this comes up so frequently in the discussion. And it's a concern I've had that it seems that the local and state governments have been remiss in not actively providing economic alternatives besides, you know, unlimited extraction. And the irony is that copper prices are very high currently, but there's no actual shortage of copper. So for both copper and other resources, where is the, you know, the nexus here between recycling, repurposing, and reusing so that communities don't have to feel that they don't have economic alternatives to destroying their own environment?
You brought up a number of points. First, I think it's absolutely true that Northeastern Minnesota has huge opportunities in creating jobs that are sustainable, and not just in tourism and recreation, but in sustainable agriculture, in energy creation that is, once again, renewable energy creation. And one of the things that has happened, actually, because of the high resource values and the technology that's available, is that many businesses that are technology dependent, whether it's healthcare or whether it's information technology, they can be located anywhere. So people who have choices would love to live someplace that's beautiful and clean and still be able to work and contribute. But there's something particularly insidious about mining, because mining not only is destructive in itself, but it is a huge coal-dependent, fossil fuel-dependent energy hog. And what that means is if you compare the amount of energy required to recycle copper, to take it out of what we've already created in phones or in pipes and reuse it, recycling is only 10% of the energy consumed in order to mine. And then the other thing is recycling can be done locally. It is more job intensive and the value added would be local. Whereas it is very clear from Polymet that what will be done locally is the blasting, the pulverizing, and only the very first steps of beneficiation and all the value-added business will be taken elsewhere. So recycling actually has become more of an answer with high commodities pricing. And the question is, why aren't our state and our federal and our local governments creating incentives for recycling? Because in just the past 4 years, the amount of copper recycling that America has done has increased approximately 60%. And right now in the United States, about 50% of the copper we get is from recycled copper. It's feasible. It's practical. It has much fewer consequences for global warming. And the number of jobs that it would create are much more likely to be local and present jobs. So I'm not saying we shouldn't have cell phones. I'm saying we have dug enough stuff out of the ground. Let us use what we have and let us reuse, and let's make our phones so that they can be easily broken apart and create some obligations so that we have a chance to take our products back when we want the new cell phone rather than throw it into the dumpster and be done with it.
Excellent point. Well, Paula McAbee, to wind up, I'd just like to know where you are now in the review process for the permits. And as we get to the end game here, ultimately, who decides?
Well, where we are now, PolyMet initially came out with what they call a draft environmental impact statement in 2009. And that's a sort of a summary of what they think their impacts of the project are and what the project should be. At that time, there were about 3,000 citizens who commented, and the Environmental Protection Agency, which is a federal agency, looked at the draft environmental review documents and said the study itself is inadequate and the project would be environmentally unsatisfactory, and basically told the PolyMet proponents to go back and do some more work. Well, it's several years later, and I have read now the preliminary new environmental review documents and their track changes version, and my opinion is that the environmental impact statement is still inadequate and the project is still environmentally unsatisfactory and would harm irreplaceable wetlands and would also result in hundreds, if not thousands, of years of water pollution. But this time, we have worked as a coalition, a number of environmental groups, citizens groups, faith groups, and we've got the government to agree to have a process that's open to citizens. There will be public meetings, one in the Aurora Hoyt Lakes area, one in Duluth, and one in the Twin Cities, where people can come and they can actually have their voice heard. And there will be a chance for them to hear other citizens and have their words taken down by a court reporter so that someone will be paying attention. Now, how is the decision going to be made? There are lots of places where PolyMet's project could fall down. It could fall down because the environmental review documents are still lousy. It could fall down because a project has to the state has to certify that a project will comply with the Clean Water Act or it shouldn't go forward. So there are lots of layers of review. I think eventually, assuming that commodity prices are high and the marketplace is not saying this is a bad idea, it is quite likely that this case will either be decided by politicians saying, no, enough is enough, or by courts saying, this project does not meet the requirements of the law. And so what citizens can do to be involved is to help, first of all, get informed. Get informed. Get on the waterlegacy.org website. Learn more about the project and talk to people. Talk to your neighbors. Talk to your elected officials and say, you expect them to care about the future of Minnesota clean water and the health of the next generation and not just the job for today, because we as a community are going to be here for generations. And so whether this decision is made at the federal or the state level, all of these folks are politicians and they're all listening. So what you say in testimony, what you say in a letter to the editor, on your own Facebook page, in a call to the governor, and the governor will take call. All of these are important ways for your community to let the people in power know that we're watching and that they're accountable to protect us and our clean water.
Well, they are accountable indeed, and I'm a great proponent of cross-cutting solidarity and international and national solidarity. So for people outside of the state of Minnesota, people outside of the United States, please heed the words of our guest, Paula Maccabee. Get informed. Get your opinions out there. Spread the word, because these kinds of things could be coming to your community. And the more we know about how to be in solidarity with each other and fight smart and get leverage and be heard as citizens, the better we're all going to be. This is Jerry Williams for Radio EcoShock.
If you who are listening would like to get involved, hop onto the website waterlegacy.org. We have updates on what's happening with the PolyMet project. We have a number of fact sheets and research that you can share. We have a place that you can sign up if you want to get specific information about the PolyMet environmental review or other sulfide mines as they come closer to fruition. So please join us, become part of our movement to become informed and to make a difference in protecting water and the communities that rely on fresh and healthy clean water resources.
Thank you, Paula Maccabee, Advocacy Director and Attorney for Water Legacy.
Well, it ain't just for you, know your granddaughters too. Drink the water and your stew like you bought it in your own.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org. This is Alex Smith, taking you back to our guest host for this week's show. Jerry Williams, our fearless D.C. correspondent, moved up near Lake Superior. Sure enough, she's right in the thick of it there, in the battle to help save that northern wilderness from a really ugly mine by PolyMet Corporation. As I said at the start, there are mine battles all over the world. Here's a shout-out to my friends in British Columbia who have so far held off the Fish Lake mine, and those in Australia trying to end those gigantic climate-wrecking coal mines, and all those poor people in Africa whose voice we seldom hear as the big companies move in. Next up, we'll hear about the heavy metals, the gift that mining keeps on giving long after the corporations have left. Here's Jerry.
Bill Carter is a photographer, filmmaker, and author based in northern Arizona. His book, Boom, Bust, Boom, A Story About Copper, The Metal That Runs the World, was published last year. Radio EcoShock caught up with him recently when he talked about his book at the University of Minnesota in Duluth. Welcome, Bill Carter.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Now, your story starts in your backyard. Tell us a little bit about what happened when you planted a garden in Bisbee, Arizona, and how that led to worldwide exploration of copper and copper mining.
Yeah, Bisbee, Arizona is a little background. It's an old copper mining town. It was built to support the copper mine. It's been about 100 years, and it was a really big mine at one time, and it closed in 1975. And it kind of converted itself. It survived. A lot of copper mining towns don't survive the bust. And it did, and it reinvented itself. And it became a really interesting town. And I moved there, and I loved it, and have a lot of friends there. And my wife and I built a garden. I did. And she was pregnant with our second child. And after gardening for a while and eating the food, I got sick. Then it turned out the mining company was testing the soil in town because they already knew that our soils were contaminated, and they were replacing soil all over town. And they tested our soil and had high levels of arsenic and lead. And so they immediately moved us out of our house and placed all of our soil. And at this point now, it's been going on for about 5 years, the reclamation process, and they pretty much have replaced all the soil in Bisbee homes. And that's got me thinking. At the time I had just finished my second book, and I didn't have a third book. I'm thinking, wow, you know, I'm a well-traveled person. I've been around, I pay attention, and I don't know where I live. And it kind of clicked that thing in my brain as a writer to think, I need to go find out where I live. I need to find out what is this place, and who are the people that run this stuff? And so that made me start to research it.
And tell us about where your travels took you and kind of the impressions that you formed in going from small Bisbee, Arizona to some of the world's largest copper mines.
Well, in a strange way, it's kind of Arizona itself is the largest producer of copper in the United States. So a lot of those kind of mines are right there. So, you know, we have 11 large scale mines in Arizona producing copper. So I was able to travel right there a lot in Mexico and go into Alaska and I went other places, and it just, there's a pattern to places that have copper. How they look, how they feel, how they smell. They have a very similar vibe. Copper mining towns are utterly depressing. I found them very, very depressing places. Economically, socially, difficult places to be in. Very closed. And the prosperity that is advertised a lot, it doesn't really exist. I kept looking for it. Because that's a big part of what mining companies like to tell places that they come. If they want to build a mine, they're going to tell you that they're going to bring some prosperity. I never found it. That doesn't mean that somebody didn't work there their whole lives and put their kids through college. It just means the town itself doesn't have the infrastructure of being prosperous to me. I don't see it.
And I think a lot of us really don't know about the scale of copper mining that's taking place around the world, along with a lot of other natural resources that large companies are going after. Talk a little bit about the scale of mining that you found in different places outside of the U.S. as well.
Yeah, the scale is, it's hard to grasp it. You know, we get in our cars, we go to work, come home, have friends over for dinner, and we go to bed. At this moment, China is in the process of massively taking over Africa for their natural resources, whether it be wood, oil, farming. They're actually farming there a lot, and a thing they're doing a lot is copper mining. And also there, more importantly, and something that's very fascinating, is that is smelted in China. Well, China is choking to death, like quite literally. They're starting to have a real serious problem. So what is the solution? They're moving all the smelting operations to Africa. They're building the smelters in Africa, and they're exporting their pollution there. Africa is pretty much ground central for resource extraction right now for all these companies. The amount of energy going into this is almost inconceivable. It's going at the pace of extraction is incredible.
Well, one might think, well, gee, why, let's just not mine copper because, you know, it's one of the world's leading producers of pollution and toxic chemicals that come with taking the copper out of where it is. But you've concluded that copper is the indispensable metal that we have to have for modern life. Now, what leads you to say that?
Well, nobody's replaced it. If someone could replace it, then fantastic. Again, it's not the copper itself. Copper itself is incredibly useful. We need it in our blood to live. It's a very useful metal, but it has a problem of being what we call native copper. which is pure copper veins, like a gold vein, they don't really exist anymore. Those were pretty harmless. Take a big old hammer and just slam it down and it comes out.
They're gone.
They're gone. The only thing left is getting copper in tiny specks, and that's a sulfide mine. The extraction of the copper from the sulfide is what creates the big problem. Now, if someone could create an alloy or anything that would replace the conductivity of copper, which is really what it's used for, electricity, then that would be fantastic. But it hasn't happened yet. Will it happen? Probably. Just like green energy is taking maybe a generation to shift into, and that's okay. It's compromises. There's a bit of a bridge maybe, a little bit of oil, a little bit of this, a little bit of natural gas, a little bit of green energy, and then finally we have to move there. I think at some point we'll find that with copper. I hope. The problem is copper is very cheap to industry. They make profit after about $1.30 a pound. Right now it's $3 a pound or more. So they're making an enormous amount of money on this. So until you have a copper crash like you did in the 70s, just like with cars, right? When we have a lot of, when oil's cheap, suddenly we have big cars. When oil's expensive, suddenly we have Fiats. So copper's like that. If we can find a way for the market to squeeze copper, then maybe our scientists or our, you know, inventors will start to create some other way to replace copper, some other alloy.
But in the meantime, the demand is very high. And as you've spoken about, written about, there's 168,000 tons of copper in all of our personal computers. 100 tons of earth is moved for is it 1 ton of copper?
Half a ton.
For a half a ton of copper. And, you know, so our demand for our cell phones, for our Priuses, for our computers, these all entail huge amounts of copper. And the demand is rising worldwide as more countries like China and India move into another standard of living. But, you know, it's interesting, though, that although you're living in a town where the mine closed down, generations later, years later, the results are still showing up in your groundwater and the vegetables that you're growing. So the harm from all of this mining is very long-lived.
It's much longer than 100 years. It'll go on for, you know, it's like radioactivity, you know, has a 10,000-year life or whatever they say. These toxic metals are very hard to break down. It harks back to copper mining companies. When they come to a town, they sell the short game. You know, they have a lot of shiny objects. They're like the new Western frontiermen. They're bringing a lot of shiny objects, and it sounds really good. But they're not going to be the people or even the company who's here in 100 years when this damage really starts to percolate. And they know that, and they know that you don't know that. They know that you're just buying into the shiny objects. It's not complicated. It's what they do. In terms of the bigger question, the reason I wrote the book, the reason I wanted to finish the book, is to dig into that philosophical question, to have it, to start it. I don't have the answer for how to replace this stuff, but I do know that we quite often don't think about it. We don't think about all the things that we like and that we want and that we are working at jobs for so we can buy. We don't think about it. And maybe there's a moment where we have to take a pause as a people and say, you know what, maybe we don't want to export, for instance, all this to Africa where they have child labor, or Indonesia where they pay people $1 an hour for our, it's a little bit like the clothing industry, right? In China. We have to think about this a little bit. And then let's say the clothing industry, they started to hold those companies to accountability, boycott them or whatever, and they have to change their ways, or we hope they do. Maybe that's something we do with mining companies. Or maybe we change so that we don't have as much, or we recycle more, or we do a lot of other things. But right now, it's like a steam machine. It's like cockroaches. We just have to get more and more and more, and it's driving this industry.
Yeah, you're really talking about conscious consumption. And it's hard to really understand a product life cycle. And it's so easy to have mindless buying and have no idea of that life cycle, where it started, who it involved, who it impacted, and the disposal too. And so you've mentioned recycling. I've heard that actually we've mined so much copper in all of our goods that we use that we could be able to extract some of it and recycle and meet modest needs, but not an ever-increasing use of it. Have you heard any discussions about that in your travels, that people are looking at using recycling copper and other metals as a way to generate the jobs? Because the jobs is one of these big promises that companies make when they move into an area.
Well, recycling copper is a really thriving worldwide business. It's its own little shadow market. It's huge. It's quite large. And it plays a part in copper market, for instance. You go to a scrap metal market outside your town, wherever you live, I guarantee you that they are very happy when someone brings in copper. And it all gets shipped to China, almost all of it. And China knows how to recycle that copper. They're very good at it, and they use it. It's in your car or your computer. Because remember, copper.
So they give it back to you.
They give it back to you
as a good.
As a product. So it does get recycled, really, because copper is in many ways that perfect metal. You can recycle it. It's 100% recyclable. It doesn't decay in that way. There's a number that's quite staggering. 80% of the copper that's been mined for the last 6,000 years is in use. So it's not sitting in a yard. It's in use. The Egyptians used a lot of copper. That copper got recycled, and now you don't know where it is because it doesn't go away. So copper is like a perfectly recyclable metal, and it is recycled heavily around the world. We probably don't recycle it enough.
Meaning we Americans.
We Americans. Other countries recycle copper very seriously. Africa does. Asia does. We just kind of throw the whole thing away. We throw the whole refrigerator away or whatever it is. They don't do that. They strip the copper out and go recycle it.
Mm-hmm.
But there's a lot of crime involved in recycling these days. A lot of syndicates run it. But a little bit like right now in the green energy, wind power is accounting for, you know, a small percentage of the energy's grid. Eventually, it'd be nice to have wind and solar be like half. That'd be phenomenal. Right now, it's really tiny. The copper market of recycling is very small. It's important, but it's very small. To get it to be the whole grid, I can't imagine that's ever possible. You'd have to have a perfect cycle. It's not going to be enough for the actual perfect cycle of product and recycling. Also has to match China and India and Brazil and Turkey and these countries building at a phenomenal rate. And it won't match it. You're always going to have new copper.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's very complicated, that's for sure. You've talked about a bigger conversation that concerned citizens need to have on the discussion of copper mining. And I think this applies to lots of other environmental questions too. The question has to be no mines. The question has to be more nuanced and discriminating to talk about, number one, how can it be done better? And even according to you, the mining executives and hydrologists and geologists really don't know how to do long-term containment of these toxins that are released and captured in one place. They migrate. It gets into the groundwater. They're still working on that. They'll get back to us.
Right.
But the other part is being aware of what is going on with other struggles. You mentioned Pebble Beach. Talk about that a bit, and then we'll connect it to other things that are...
You mean Pebble Mine, sorry.
Pebble Mine.
Ironically, they wanted to call it Pebble Beach. Mm-hmm. I was in a helicopter with some mining executives taking a tour of Pebble Mine, and like the CEO. And they kind of forgot I was in the helicopter, and they told a joke. And the joke was, oh, when we first saw it, we wanted to call it Pebble Beach because it looked like a great layout for a golf course. And I said, oh, that's nice. And then they said, no, that'd be rude, so we called it Pebble Mine.
And where is it located?
Pebble Mine is located near Lake Iliamna, which is the largest lake in Alaska, which is about 300 miles to the west of Anchorage, over the Alaskan Range. A very, very rugged, very remote territory. This is really remote. The only people out there are Native Alaskans, Athabascan or Yupik. So this is very remote. These are subsistence people. They live off the fish. They live off hunting. This mine would be located 14 miles from that lake, Iliamna. Lake Iliamna has half the world's sockeye salmon are born in that lake. And then they go down the river systems into Bristol Bay. And then every year they come back, half of them come back and go up the river systems and are reborn. Well, if you've ever been near in a copper area region, 14 miles is a very short amount of distance for the toxins to travel to the water source. In Alaska, you're talking about, in Arizona we have hard rock. In Alaska, it's tundra. It doesn't have to go 50 feet down or 1,000 feet down to get to an aquifer. It has to go about 6 inches. And then it's going to be cruising down toward the lake. They think they can contain that. Here's the question. There's people in Arizona that have been working on this stuff for 100 years, on and off, you know, to different generations, how to stop it when it goes 1,000 feet down through hard rock, not to go 80 miles to an aquifer. How are you going to stop a mine this is a huge mine, one of the biggest in the world built, from going 14 miles on tundra? They've already admitted that they would ruin 2 to 3 entire streams of salmon, they would have to dry them out. Remember, one of the things about copper mining people don't understand, when you have an open pit, which they're proposing, let's say here, the Polymet, you're basically building an enormous toilet bowl. The only way that the mine can operate, you have to take all the water surrounding that toilet bowl. It has to go away. There can be no water. And remember, when you dig 1,000 feet into the earth, you're going to have a lot of water wherever you are. It's going to be natural. Yet that has to all go away through pumps. All that water has to be diverted around the mine. So now you have a dry hole. Now all the water is being diverted somewhere. And usually what they do is they capture that water, part of it, and then they use that same water to process the copper in the extraction process. Now that water is full of toxins. They try to treat it, and they try to have a self-contained operation with that water leaching process, while the other water that's being diverted just goes to, you know, downstream. But they control it. Once you turn the pumps off, once you leave in 50 years, and they don't leave the pumps on, they go off, this water will start to go back in that hole. Berkeley pit in Montana, great example. In Butte, it's a very, very toxic pit that's on the edge of the town. I think the town has about 20 more years before it's basically overrun by the water. It's going to overflow the pit, and we won't be able to live there because it's poisonous. So that's what happens with open pits. Now, can they change that? They haven't figured out how.
Well, I bring up the Pebble Mine because not only would that be a big mine, but it's also in an area of one of the world's largest salmon production.
Yeah, and it is the world's largest salmon place. Half the world's fish come from there, salmon fish. So the idea that it is even being thought of or even being considered, to me, is the concept of lunacy. Why would we ever threaten not only a state resource that brings in about $1.5 billion, 14,000 jobs? Why would we threaten that? But it's also a national resource, and more importantly, it's a world resource. These fish feed millions of people, very healthy food. Why would we ever threaten it? And right now we're in a battle, huge battle, to try to stop it.
It's a tipping point.
It is, I believe, because Pebble Mine is a tipping point.
Because it's such an example of where we're going to draw the line, where are we going to site these places. And you've mentioned that there are places in the world that are remote, that are dry, where people are not living around them, where you can, you know, decently mine copper. But as, you know, more and more encroachment on human habitat and other, you know, sensitive and environmentally important habitat, I think people are going to be starting to question not just the not in my backyard, but as you mentioned before, being aware of where this is taking place in other parts of the world, so that the various campaigns and movements to stop dangerous mines is not just isolated to this is my place, I'll only fight for my place,
right.
But we need to know about what's going on in other places and bring power to bear on that.
I everywhere I go, I try to tell them, if you don't fight for Pebble, you're not going to win your battle. If Pebble's allowed to go through, I can't imagine another battle that would ever win. Because, I mean, unless you said I want to build a mine in Minneapolis downtown, that probably wouldn't happen. But I can't imagine another resource that even compares to that. Not in my backyard stuff. I mean, just literally a world resource. So it is a tipping point, and it is also a place that has had an enormous success of coalition of people battling against this. These people come with a lot of money and determination. They don't. This is not a game of tetherball. They're coming with some hardcore. This is hard. They're playing for real. So the coalitions have to be really united. They have to be very focused, and they have to have really good arguments. And the argument isn't no mining. That can't be the argument. The argument has to more be framed by not a mine at this spot, but then this is why. Why? Because it's precious water. We need it. Why? Because maybe we have better jobs. Maybe we have a more diverse economy. You know, these are the reasons you have to lay down. You can't just walk around with a picket and say, I don't want a mine. That's not going to cut it. And Pebble is a great example of people who normally do not get along at all, getting along for this battle.
Well, I'm glad to hear that. And so to wrap it up, I'd like to just talk about this kind of coalition building and really how people can, in communities, fight back against these mines. And I'm discouraged because, you know, divestment, maybe that's one way to look at it. Boycotts, marches, and things like that don't really, that's not really what we're facing as we're moving forward. And multinational corporations are basically trying to just get anything that's not nailed down. And now that corporations are people, as the U.S. Supreme Court has said, their money can trump citizen power, particularly since they can donate so freely to politicians. How do you see this playing out? What would you suggest from your travels and what you've seen? What are things that people can do? You've mentioned a few, you know, coalitions. Any other ideas on how people can, number one, inform themselves better and bring more power to bear against the big corporations?
Not just here, but like
everywhere.
Throughout. Okay.
Everywhere.
You know, I think that it's, like you said, being informed maybe of where you get your things. What are you having, you know, that day? What have you bought? You know, you go back to you just mentioned the Supreme Court decision on corporations are people, which takes us back to a place that we've heard a lot since we were kids. And with the last round in Washington, we get a little bit more cynical. But the last round in Washington over the debt talks and the budget also tell us something. As much as you want to become cynical that these people can't get along, it also shouldn't tell you in a very, very, very big wake-up call, it matters who you elect. It matters who gets elected to office. Because those people are the ones that speak for us. And I don't necessarily like the system all the time, but that's how the way it works. So we got to put pressure on those people, like big pressure. They can't just go, they can't represent one thing like they did in the Tea Party and nothing else. So I think it matters that who we elect. Maybe have to tell them what matters to us. And the way you do that is like these comment periods or whatever these are. Affecting things is really hard. You know, it's really interesting. I've been involved in activism for 25 years. And literally, like, affecting a single person, affecting a single issue is very, very challenging.
It takes generations.
It takes generations. Mm-hmm. But you got to lay down the groundwork. You got to believe in it. And you got to sometimes reach out to people that you – like, for instance, let's take this issue right here, right now. PolyMet, right here. I don't know enough about it, but I know it's in a place, the iron ore region, that's very proud of mining. And I think they have a hard time. Those miners want the mine. And those miners might not even know why they want the mine. They just want the mine out of nostalgia, out of what they know. Well, they need to reach out to those guys. Don't just be like, they won't talk to us. Reach out to them. Explain to them why it matters that you shouldn't have this. You know, I think we need to reach out across to people that maybe are saying no, or they don't want to know, or they're burying their head in the sand, and kind of appreciate where they're coming from. Maybe they're stubborn, and maybe they just have generations involved in that particular place that they want the mine or whatever it is. We need to reach out to them and talk to them.
You find some common ground because it literally is our common ground.
It's common ground. It kind of goes, the thing I'm thinking about that is a parallel is organic food. Okay. I grew up on a farm. I'm 47. I grew up on a farm in the 70s. When I lived on that farm, the word organic wasn't even something that we even knew about. We just ate the food off our farm. And all the food that came from other farms, we traded for. It was just like 100 years ago, the word organic was not even invented, if you will, in terms of food, because everything was organic. And now there was a little stage, I think it's changing now, but there was a little stage where if I bought organic and you didn't, then I was a snob. I spent too much money. I was saying something about you. And now you have more people suddenly realizing now over a generation, like, why would I eat food that I know is heavily contaminated with pesticides when I can have an organic product? That's not snobbish. That is just common sense of your body and eating. And that's kind of parallel. Like, it took a while. Maybe somewhere doesn't want to go, but like you said, common ground, common water. Mm-hmm. It's the water. Do you really want to screw up the water?
Yeah.
And even the guy who might seem really stubborn in his shack and doesn't want to talk to you probably doesn't want to screw up his water. So you can start there.
For him or his kids.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Right.
Well, thank you so much, Bill Carter, for sharing time with us. This is Jerry Williams for Radio EcoShock.
Radio EcoShock.
Out of time again for another week. Keep listening to Radio EcoShock at www.ecoshock.org. I'm Alex Smith. Find my show blog with links to our stories this week at ecoshock.info. Please support this program if you can. Thank you so much for listening, and let's check in again next week. We're heading out with more music from northern Minnesota from a group of artists called the Arrowhead Story. Google it.